If you've spent any time in the American Southeast, you've probably come across this strange vine. And not just any vine, a vine that can devour entire hillsides and forests, as well as buildings and roads. A vine that is so feared by the local populace that there are stories of it not only destroying the local wildlife, but killing animals and even people that venture into its depths. For decades, mothers have warned their children about venturing into the Appalachian Green Inferno. And while the narrative persists that this plant is an invader looking to destroy anything that comes in its wake, I want to ask, is there more to the story? Hello everybody, today we're going to talk about the strange story of Kudzu, aka Japanese arrowroot, aka mile a minute, aka the vine that ate the South. If you're not from the Southeast, Kudzu is a vine that is everywhere, and I mean everywhere. While you'll normally see it next to roadways or on the sides of cliffs or over dead forests, the vine famously seems to creep its way into pretty much everything else as well. If you are from the South, then you're probably familiar with the broad strokes of the story. The vine was introduced to the American South in the early 20th century, and from there has become a nuisance at best and a danger at worst. But the true story of how Kudzu became so prominent in the United States is far more interesting than that brief misconception may lead you to believe. And of course, if you're like me and grew up with legends of the almost evil qualities that the plant has, well then it certainly begs the question of how it became so hated in the first place. So I want to talk about the history of Kudzu in the United States, how it was originally touted as a hero of restoration before immediately becoming the villain of agricultural stories. And of course, talk about if there's any truth to people, you know, dying. And perhaps most importantly, what Kudzu might mean to the American future. Now, there were a lot of different sources of information I used for this video. However, there's one in particular I want to shout out. When I was looking for the best source on everything Kudzu, most people pointed to this book, Devoured: The Extraordinary Story of Kudzu, The Vine That Ate the South. It does a great job at not only laying out the history and a lot of the mythos around Kudzu, but a lot of the modern expansions and scientific endeavors that have been done with the plant. It was written by Aurella Horn Mueller, who I was able to get in contact with before I made this video, and I can confirm to you that she is very kind and cool. So if this topic interests you at all and you want to hear an actual, you know, like writer, journalist talk about it instead of whatever the green screen in my closet is, then I highly encourage you to check out the book. It will be linked in the description. I'm glad that there's people out there who are smart so that people like me can pretend to be smart. And if you've never heard of Kudzu before and wonder why so many people can find a vine to be so scary, then stick around because we're going to talk about it today. So after a word from today's sponsor, we're going to talk about the super evil deadly vine that is trying to kill you, which you should probably be worried about. And speaking of things that creep into our life and make everything worse, unneeded subscriptions. Because I'm sure we've all had a time when we're trying to save for something or just take a look at our finances and can't believe the amount of money we've spent on forgotten or unneeded subscriptions. Well, today's sponsor, Rocket Money, is here to help. Rocket Money is the personal finance app that helps you cancel subscriptions, lower bills, and manage your money better. Rocket Money allows you to keep track of your personal finances in one place and then act accordingly. For example, it keeps record of all of your recurring bills and subscriptions, and if you want, from within the Rocket Money app, with just a couple clicks, you can cancel the things you don't need. Rocket Money can also analyze your spending patterns in order to help you set budgets and even send you notifications based on your spending. Rocket Money can even help you lower your bills. All you have to do is send them a picture of whatever bill you're paying, and it will negotiate on your behalf. Everything from internet service to cable to phone bills, Rocket Money can help you start paying less or completely cancel out money you don't have to spend. Rocket Money has helped save its customers up to $740 a year when they use all the features, with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. So to save more and spend less, join the over 5 million users using Rocket Money today. And all you need to do that is go to rocketmoney.com/Wendigoon to get started on Rocket Money right now for free. Yes, that is right, for free. From there, you can unlock premium to get even more features. But for now, just try it out at no cost to you, rocketmoney.com/Wendigoon to get in on this fantastic offer today. Thank you all so much for watching the ad. Thank you so much to Rocket Money for sponsoring the video. Really does mean the most. Hope you all check them out. Link is in the description, and we are back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. So to start off, what is katsu? I'll talk about the logistics of it as we get further into the video, but all you need to know for now is that it's a very long vine that produces a very large leaf. And as the name suggests, it is not native to the United States and was instead introduced from Japan. The vine seems to have began all the way back in ancient China, but by at least like 500 BC, it was predominant in both China and Japan. The perhaps more formal name of katsu, Japanese arrowroot, coming from the broad arrow-shaped leaves that the vine produces. The vine was used for ornamental and some holistic purposes that we'll talk about later while it was in Asia, but it wasn't introduced to the United States until 1876, to which it was then showcased at the first United States World Fair at Fairmount Park, Philadelphia. See, the World's Fair was, as the name suggests, all of the greatest thinkers, artists, and what have you from around the world coming to one location to showcase their country's offerings. One of these nations was Japan, and while the majority of their focus at the World's Fair was on things like their architecture and artwork, one of the more subtle details of this expo was a seemingly inconspicuous vine called katsu. The name katsu being the Japanese word, or at least a derivative of the Japanese word, for the plant. At this expo, it was advertised as being an ornamental plant that could be used for things like shading a porch. See, the vine grew so fast and the leaves of it were so large, the idea was you could have kind of an open-top gazebo and allow the plant to bloom, and you would have a naturally shaded area. While a few people thought this was neat and it was adopted to some degree, its grand debut would come 8 years later. It was then at the New Orleans World's Industrial and Cotton Centennial Exposition that the plant would be showcased for a new purpose, soil erosion. See, for anyone cultivating crops, it's important to have good soil composition. So you want a healthy mixture of topsoil that's created out of biomaterials and chemicals within the ground and general soil composition. Otherwise, crops won't grow well, and there's a high chance of crops dying out if they do begin to grow. Around the late 1800s, this was beginning to become a problem in the United States. While soil can be maintained to a healthy degree if you're simply harvesting and planting in the right seasons and you're not doing it too much, as industry became more and more standardized across the United States, people kept trying to plant more and more. This put stress on a lot of the soil, especially in the American South, and it was becoming harder to grow things. However, as was showcased at the New Orleans Expo, katsu is a fantastic tool at refertilizing used ground. This is because katsu is good at introducing the correct levels of things like nitrogen and oxygen into the ground, and the plant matter itself allows other things to grow. And as mentioned, katsu is a really fast-growing vine, so hypothetically you just need a little bit of it to revitalize your topsoil. On top of that, in 1902, a man named Charles Pleas realized that katsu is also really good food for farm animals. And considering people were already discovering that the vine kind of grows anywhere you plant it, the fact that it's so cheap and easy made it a good alternative for livestock feed. So in 1902, Charles Pleas began to mail out seedlings of katsu for farmers to put in their fields. In 1920, John Rigdon of Central Georgia Railroad began to build his company off of shipping katsu bales, which is effectively hay bales, but, you know, made out of katsu. And already within a couple decades, katsu made its way around the South fast. Farmers who were previously having trouble growing anything can now grow pretty much whatever they want and feed the animals at the same time. On top of that, the vine grew so fast and was able to spawn other new growths off of itself, which will become a very big problem later, that it only took a little bit of katsu to get things rolling. However, it was in the 1930s that things began to accelerate very quickly. From the Dust Bowl that was happening in the Midwest to the Great Depression, the US economy and things like food systems were at a breaking point. A botanist named David Fairchild, who worked with the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, was living in Washington, D.C. and began to grow katsu because he found it interesting. And while several farmers in the South were beginning to adopt katsu in order to fix their farms, it wasn't anything to a large scale. So that meant a lot of potential food providers, things that could put an ease on the economy, were still unable to grow anything. So Fairchild, as well as his other co-workers at the USDA, took a look at this katsu and decided that might be the solution to their problems. Basically, the government was scratching their heads like, oh no, if only there was a super fast-growing plant that could thrive in any conditions and simultaneously refertilize the soil we put it in. And Fairchild was like, oh yeah, I've got some at the house. So beginning in 1935, the Department of Agriculture begins to heavily push kudzu onto the American South. President Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps began to plant the vine anywhere they could. The two reasons that all of the planting occurred in the American Southeast is, for one, that's where all the farming and agriculture is, because, you know, the Midwest is dusty, and two, it was seen that the vine could not grow, or at least not grow well, in cold temperatures, and it stays hot enough year-round in the American Southeast. So the Conservation Corps is planting it all over public land, but that's not enough because there's a lot of farmers who still can't produce anything, so the government chooses to incentivize those guys to let them plant kudzu. The federal government begins to offer farmers $8 an acre of planted kudzu, which, adjusted for inflation, is about $180 per acre today. So picture this, you're a farmer who is struggling to make ends meet, and then one day the government comes to you and says, hey, we've got this magic plant that your animals can eat, and it'll fix the farm, and if you've got 100 acres, we'll pay you modern equivalent $18,000 to put it on there. So obviously, everyone said yes. And as predicted, it worked. Kudzu revitalized a lot of farmlands and put an ease on a lot of struggling farmers in an already struggling economy. Because of this, the vine quickly adopted this, like, sacred status among people in the region. There was one radio announcer and journalist named Channing Cope who had a radio program outside of Covington, Georgia, that he would broadcast every day, kind of like an almanac of sorts about farm life and how farmers are doing and whatnot. And in every broadcast, he would talk about the miracle of kudzu. By miracle, I'm not making a joke. The dude would outright call it, you know, a gift sent from God to save America. And for most people, this seemed to be the common sentiment. Things were going bad, and now they're going good, and this miracle plant seems to be a big part of that. Channing Cope founded an organization called the Kudzu Club, which was pretty much a club for proliferating kudzu, spreading the good word, so to speak, to farmers around the American Southeast, and at one point, it had about 20,000 members. Because of this, Channing Cope earned the nickname of the Kudzu Kid. It's estimated that through the 1930s and 40s, the government planted about 85 million seedlings of kudzu, with an estimated 3 million acres of kudzu planted, which is about 4,680 square miles. And for a few years, everyone was happy, kudzu was doing its job, and everything is great. Until it wasn't. So in the 1940s, you know, the whole war thing happens, and a bunch of people who were meticulously watching their farms are now off to fight the war. On top of that, again, industrialization is constantly on the rise in the United States, so a bunch of people are moving from their farms to cities and leaving the kudzu unattended. So as mentioned, the vine grows pretty fast, and as people go to remove the vine, they quickly realize that they can't. They try digging it up, and that doesn't work. They try burning it. That doesn't work. They tried completely destroying the soil and everything around it. Somehow the vine still comes back. What they didn't realize is that, yes, the kudzu was fine when it was being monitored and used, again, for things like plant feed or cultivated with the crops around it. But once kudzu's taken root somewhere, it's really hard to convince it otherwise. So when kudzu is planted, it will grow a sort of primary root that the other shoots of the leaves and whatnot will grow off of. That primary root can get up to 100 feet long, weigh as much as 400 pounds, and be 7 inches in diameter. Not only that, but the stems that come off of the root within about a year's cycle can become their own primary root system. And when I say these things grow fast, I mean fast. It is estimated, and while like the exact number of this is kind of debated, it's at least close, that kudzu can grow a foot a day. That is so fast that you could stare at it long enough and watch it move. Imagine you have a farm and you've got kudzu 100 feet away from your house. and then you leave the house for a year. When you come back, you no longer have a house. The Kudzu has the house, and maybe you can get in. And that's no joke about the Kudzu overtaking the house. Kudzu is what's known as a structural parasite. In other words, the root system itself, or you know, the vines, leaves, whatever, don't have any structure above ground, so they just cling on to whatever's nearby. Add to that the fact that they thrive in areas with low nitrogen and low resources, and kudzu will grow over any man-made structure it comes into contact with. So okay, you have this giant vine that is really big, and it can overtake stuff you build. Well, just dig it up, right? Well, for one, as mentioned, that can be really hard considering how big these things can get, but also, as mentioned, within a year, the stems can become their own root system. So even if you pull up the main root, better hope it wasn't there that long. Otherwise, you've just created more. If you chop up kudzu with like a lawnmower or something, you have to either burn or use the plant material for animal food or something. Because otherwise, all you've done is disperse it into new places all over the yard. It doesn't take long for one root of kudzu to become thousands of roots around an area. The one kind of saving grace you can get is if you go to the crown, or like the main part of the root system, and cut it off and then destroy it, like it's some kind of monster or something. If you destroy the crown, then that root will die, but as mentioned, if it's been there too long, the other stems will just create their own roots and you're back at square one. Add to this the fact that they're drought tolerant, frost tolerant. As mentioned, they don't grow well in cold conditions, but the cold won't kill them, it will just kind of slow them down. And the fact that in the United States they have no natural predators, like the kudzu beetle that was back in Japan, and people began to realize this pretty quick. See, another one of the really big problems with kudzu is, remember the really big leaf I talked about, how it could be used as, you know, shade on your porch or whatever, and the fact that the vine needs something else to cling onto and grow over. That is a really bad combination for any other plants in the area, because the vine will outgrow any other plant in speed, so all it needs to do is find another plant, overtake it, completely block out all sunlight for that plant, and the plant underneath dies. This led to several of the unattended farms and areas where kudzu was planted becoming a total dead zone, because the plant had completely outcompeted any other flora in the region. It didn't take long for the government to catch on to this, and in 1953, it was removed from the list of like permissible cover plants, and you know, the whole you should plant it all the time and we'll pay you for it. But by then, the damage was already done, and it wasn't stopping anytime soon. The tone around kudzu completely changed. It went from the hero plant that was going to revitalize the South into a monster that was to be feared. Stories of kudzu wiping out swabs of nature around entire communities, to stories of it growing over railroad tracks, leading to derailed trains, to even stories of things like, if you have a baby in a crib, you have to shut the window at night, otherwise the kudzu will grow in through the window and strangle the kid. And as mentioned, the plant does well in areas plants normally don't do well in. So the vine began to lurch its way out of the forest into cities and into streets and into people's homes. It was seen as a cancer, a stain on the South that had turned from a source of pride into one of shame. Immediately, farmers and the government at large try to find ways to kill off the plant. Sure, you can't just chop it up or whatever, but surely like a heavy dose of herbicide would do it, right? Well, no, because as mentioned, these roots are pretty intense. So even if you do use a ton of herbicide, you're just gonna kill off the stuff above ground, and then give it a while, it will all be regrown just as it was. The only way to really kill it off with chemicals is through routine spraying of an area to try to kill the roots as they get like weaker and weaker over time. And by most estimates, it takes about 10 years of concentrated spraying to wipe out kudzu in an area. Even in the modern age, with all of our super cool chemicals we have now, the quickest we can get it down to is like 2 years. And even then, we're using these incredibly toxic chemicals that require a whole process of like sanctioning off an area and then spraying it for 2 years and then lifting the biohazard and going somewhere else. Okay, so if that doesn't work, what if we try introducing a natural predator? Well, while a few things like the kudzu beetle mentioned earlier have found their way into the U.S., it's not in any large amount. They just came over naturally. The issue with introducing a non-native species into an area to remove something you don't like is what got us here in the first place. There is catalogs of times we have tried to mess with a local wildlife population to get a better result and have made everything way, way worse. And as mentioned, stuff like pigs, cows, goats, whatever, they'll eat it, but the number of animals you would have in order to take out entire forest of kudzu would be insane. So pretty much the solution was to do nothing. There is no feasible way to remove the plant, and the plant doesn't seem to stop growing. To give you an idea of how stubborn this plant is, and I'm jumping ahead in the timeline a little bit, in recent years, a middle school in Winfield, Alabama had this like big school project they did with NASA to see how kudzu would grow in space. So they took kudzu and tested its growth potential on the International Space Station. And it turns out not only does it grow fine, it grows better in zero gravity than it does on Earth. Meaning that kudzu is so powerful, gravity is just a mere obstacle for it. It doesn't even need the stuff. In 1998, the government added kudzu to its noxious weeds list, which effectively classifies it as a weed that needs gotten rid of. Keep in mind, this is the same plant that was once sold at $180 an acre to convince people to put it on their land. It was labeled as a noxious weed in 98 and then was removed from the noxious weed list in 2000. Seemingly, because after looking into it for 2 years, there was no solution, so they just ignored the problem. So where does all that get you? Well, it gets you where we are today. Growing up in East Tennessee, I saw kudzu absolutely everywhere. There is not a road near my house I can think of where you didn't see it growing off the side of a cliff or on an abandoned barn. When I was a little kid, I just assumed it was like grass and that it was a thing that can just pop up anywhere. I so vividly remember being 8, 9 years old and playing outside with friends, and then one of our parents would tell us not to go into the kudzu, that it's dangerous. And sure, while that's certainly true for some degree, shaded areas like that could be a place a snake would hide under, or the kudzu may cover up a ditch you could fall into and wouldn't otherwise see. But I knew some kids who had stories from their parents about how if you ran out into the vines, they would wrap around your legs and get you stuck out there. Or some stories of the vine eating people, that it wanted to catch you, like a Venus flytrap almost, and it would pull you down below the sea of green and then eat off your body. It was treated as almost like this malicious blob that would just suck up any life that came into it. And when you look at the after effects of kudzu, it's not hard to see why. Well, at first, fields of kudzu can seem to be these lush, thriving seas of green. If the kudzu ever dies out, it reveals the damage that's been done over the years. Every other species of plant that was underneath the leaf has been blocked out from the sun for years and years, and all that's left is the decay, a graveyard of what used to be. So many legends that my grandfather would tell me would be rooted around kudzu itself. Stories of monsters that lived out in caves of kudzu, or these creatures that would drag kids off at night and they'd never be found because their body would be lying underneath the sea of kudzu. Kudzu also has this strange effect because to keep it at bay, you have to trim it over and over several times a year. So if any property becomes abandoned for any length of time, it quickly falls victim to the wave of green goo. It's near apocalyptic in how it consumes anything that isn't actively trying to push it off. And as mentioned, when it comes to the plant itself, there's not a lot you can do. The plant has this reputation of almost a harbinger, that mistakes were made before, that the plant was introduced and it never should have been, and now we're going to pay the price for it until we're not around to keep it at bay. It's like a constant reminder of a community's mortality. It's almost like a reckoning for the South as a whole. A mistake was made and there will not be forgiveness. Things will get worse, and you can only keep them better for so long. And when I sat down to make this video, that was kind of the theme I wanted to go with. There's this plant that overtakes everything, that I see pretty much everywhere I go. And it's kind of sad when you take the whole story into effect of where it started out to where it is now. And that was until I sat down and read about where Kutsu is today, like what changes have been added to the lore, so to speak. And that's what I want to talk about now. Because yes, while the introduction of Kutsu was reckless, and while yes, several communities and groups of people have paid the price for it, there's a beauty to not only the resilience of the plan itself, but the people around it that has to be said. For one, when it comes to the control of the plant, there are some unique ways that people have entrepreneured their way into it. One of my favorites is this company called RV Farms in like Knoxville, Tennessee, where what they do is if you have kutsu, they will bring out a bunch of goats and just let the goats eat for a while and then pack them up and go home. And they'll do that as many times as you need. According to them, it takes 200 goats to clear 1 acre of kutsu a day. And again, while that's not a perfect solution, a lot of it will still grow back, it can help trim an area for a while. I mean, plus who doesn't want to like, you know, have a bunch of hungry goats on their property? That sounds great. On top of that, it turns out goats aren't the only thing that can eat kutsu. We can too. Also, I don't know why, but in my notes, I write most of these notes at like 4 in the morning and I have no idea what I was talking about. Under the category for goats, I wrote not enough dedication. I guess I meant that the goats aren't dedicated enough to keep eating. Maybe. But we certainly are dedicated when it comes to eating kutsu, because as it turns out, there's a lot of ways to do it. For one, kutsu is a comparatively pretty protein-heavy leaf, so people will use it for a substitute of things like spinach. People fry it and make kutsu chips. You can use it to make wine, you can use it to make jellies, you can use it to make like barbecue sauces. Kutsu itself, by the way, especially in the late summer, early fall, when its small flower blooms, is a very strong scent. It's kind of like a grape scent, like a sweet berry of sorts. So naturally people figured you can probably make jelly out of that, and as it turns out, you can. Now, of course, when it comes to eating kutsu, you have to find the areas that weren't dumped with the super chemicals, as mentioned earlier, which leads into its own problems, because since the government still considers it super noxious evil in all senses, they're really hesitant about you growing it or using it for stuff. So you kind of have to find a natural plot of it that hasn't been sprayed yet. But if you can, you can do some cool stuff with it. Not only food, companies like Kutsu Cabin Designs have found ways to make paper out of kutsu. As a matter of fact, when we're looking for utilitarian uses of kutsu, we just have to look to the region it came from, Japan and China. Not only have they been eating it too as, again, a sort of leafy vegetable or using it for things like tea, but it's also used in medicine. In China, kutsu extract is used as an injection to treat people who are going through severe alcohol withdrawal. There's not a ton of study in the United States on this because, again, everyone has the opinion that it is a super devil plant that is to be feared. But now that people are taking interest, early research in the United States is promising for potential medicinal benefit. Along with the alcohol withdrawal I mentioned a second ago, there's promising signs that it could help people with everything from diabetes to IBS. Some have even found ways to use kutsu as a building material. While the roots of it aren't strong enough to be an entire building material on their own, it can be combined with other elements to make a cost-effective option. Perhaps most promising, kutsu is a potential candidate for future biofuels, meaning kutsu, a fast-growing, hard-to-kill plant, could be used in order to propel future energies. What's also crazy about all of this, from the medicine to the food benefits to biofuel, is most of this research has happened in the last 4 or 5 years. And most of that is because how heavily it's been looked down upon culturally, and also how regulated it's been by the government. See, the government now views it as a negative because, you know, whoopsie, back in the 1930s. But the frustrating part is that view still applies to potential modern advancements with it, but it does not apply to fixing the problems they've already created. Like, once again, the author of this book, Horn Mueller, very cool, link in the description. When she was going around trying to talk to officials about you know, what the issue is, why doesn't anyone do anything about, you know, the kudzu that's still destroying land in the South and whatnot. She just kept getting ran in circles. Department of Agriculture would say that it's forestry's problem, and forestry's problem would say that it's a state-level problem, and the state would say it's actually a federal problem, and that just kept happening. No one wants to take responsibility for it, so nothing can be done, but when it comes to people making advancements in medicine and food, what have you, and trying to get it up the chain of command, they're not interested because it's, you know, the evil, awful plan. Not that we're going to do anything about it over here, but we also don't want to do anything about it over here. And the kind of tragic irony to that is that's how this all started in the first place. I kind of oversimplified in the beginning when I said that the farms were abandoned by men going off to war, going to live in the cities. But another big reason that happened is because people were poor. Not only did the Depression and Dust Bowl hit a lot of people really hard, but there was also things like weevil infestations in the South, or other plant-borne illnesses that were killing off a bunch of crops, and people couldn't afford to wait out till the next season, so they had to abandon farms that were in their family for generations. And again, when those same people were given money years prior to put kudzu on their property, that was money they couldn't afford to turn down. And while sure, everyone gets a piece of the negligence pie when it comes to that, like no one held down Channing Cope and made him say that Jesus sent kudzu to the South over the radio, it's frustrating that that negligence continues into the modern age. It's estimated that from 1960 to 2020, kudzu across all industries, agriculture, what have you, has caused an estimated $1.22 trillion in damage, or up to about $500 million a year. And that's because in several areas, it's done irreversible damage to local economies and infrastructure. And I know that this sounds like I'm just making another government bad video, which I'm not opposed to, but it's more so to say that things can take a while. So hopefully people who are finding new uses for it, finding new ways to help us use kudzu to push us into the future, maybe the tone will change. Maybe the powers that be will come around to it. Maybe they'll start to figure out that a mistake back then doesn't mean we need to make a mistake now. See, kudzu, by official accounts, is said to cover about 8 million acres of the United States currently. But that's not the real number. The real number is real higher. The 8 million figure comes from the U.S. Forestry Department. So it's 8 million acres of forest. That's not counting all the not forest that kudzu consumes. Also, the reason we can never get accurate measurements to it or whatnot is, remember that whole rigmarole of like federal and state government I mentioned earlier? Apparently, anytime they try to get funding for more studying of kudzu, both when it comes to sciences, but also just figuring out how much of it there is, they ask the government for funding, and the government's like, oh no, that's not a problem, because there's only 8 million acres of it. And then people are like, well, we don't know how many there is because we don't have funding to check. And the government's like, oh, we don't need funding. There's only 8 million acres of it. Which I guess is seen as like an acceptable loss to the state, but whatever. But despite that, despite how much area kudzu consumes, despite all the rumors about it, despite stories I grew up with as a kid that it was going to eat me alive, it never did. As a matter of fact, while I was warned of the dangers of kudzu and how awful it was and how it destroyed properties around the area I grew up in, which I'm sure is all true, I never had those feelings towards it. As a matter of fact, the only thing I really feel towards kudzu is nostalgia. It was everywhere. Everywhere I would drive, everywhere I would go, it was that same sneaky vine finding its way into the back of a barn or finding its way on the side of a cliff next to a parking lot. While it's caused a lot of problems, sure, I've always seen it as just a staple of the South. And I'm not the only one. A lot of the artwork that's been done with kudzu is beautiful. Not only are there several people who will make baskets out of kudzu, or will make these beautiful artworks out of the leaves, there's also been people who have adapted kudzu by the symbol it holds, as a defiance against the area it lives in, or the area it was forced into. In 1968, a newspaper out of Jackson, Mississippi called the Kudzu was one of the only prominent counterculture newspapers in the Deep South. It spoke against Vietnam, it spoke against a lot of the social issues of the time, and adopted the name Kudzu because it was something that was different than the land it was in, but trying to change it. And obviously, however many times kudzu's been mentioned in film and music. I think one of my favorite pieces of art that has to do with kudzu is a series called Kudzilla by Casey Lance Brown. And it's a series of art pieces he did where it's kudzu consuming different man-made structures, like old gas stations, or old buildings, or shops, or restaurants. And to me, it captures a lot of kind of that horror I grew up with, right? The spirit of kudzu being this all-encompassing monster that's just biding its time till it strikes the next thing that we've built, the next monument it's going to tear down. But by the very fact that the art exists, that someone has seen the kudzu as more than just a plant, but as a symbol, as something that has a tone, a mythos, an aura to it, I think is beautiful. And to be honest, I don't know what kudzu is going to be 20 years from now. I don't know what it'll be 10, 5 years from now. But I think it'll be better. Perhaps a breakthrough will be made in science and it will become a new source of medicine or a new source of energy. Or perhaps it will continue to be on the outskirts of society as I've known it. And more people will adopt it culturally, will adopt it for its art form or its roots or its stories. I don't know where it'll be, but what I do know is it's beautiful to see something that was once seen as valuable and then seen as explicitly unvaluable now be made into something again, something worth talking about. And if there's one thing I know about the people around it, is that much like the plant itself, they're pretty resilient. So regardless of what kudzu is, regardless of the damage it's done, hopefully it can be something better in the future. And hopefully you enjoyed this mindless rant into all of that you probably don't care about, but I sure do, so I just want to say thank you for watching. Thank you all so much for watching. It really does mean the world. I appreciate it. Again, this is something that I've just grown up with, something that I've wanted to talk about for a while now, and it means a lot that you guys are willing to put up with it. I really do appreciate it. It is way too late. I need to get to editing this. Like I said, huge shout out to a Urella Horn Mueller. A link to the book will be in the description. Check it out. She certainly deserves it. Thank you so much to Rocket Money for sponsoring this video, and Stalker tickets are in the description. Get them while you can. But for real, thank you guys. Hopefully kudzu means something to you in at least a little bit as it does to me. And if it doesn't, well, thank you for putting up with that anyway. It means a lot. I'm going to get to editing this and sleeping, hopefully. Hopefully you enjoyed it. And I just want to say thank you for watching. Hope that you enjoyed. And I will see you in the next one. Bye!